So it would be not replaceable.
We'll call the meeting to order. This is the State Government Finance Committee meeting for Thursday, February 10th, 2011. We're still waiting for one or two members. There's getting close. We have a quorum?
Yep.
We have a quorum. So Representative Lilly, I know, has studied the minutes overnight. And would you care to move? Would you care to move the minutes, Representative Lilly?
I'd be honored, Mr. Chair.
The minutes are on the table. Are there any additions or corrections to the minutes from yesterday?
It was sweet dreams for Representative Lilly.
They were indeed.
Hearing no additions or corrections, all in favor of the minutes from yesterday, February 9th, signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried. Our bill today that we have is House File 4. Representative Downey, welcome to the committee.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. I would move HF4 for possible inclusion in a future bill or an omnibus state government finance bill.
Okay. The bill is on the table. Do you want to take care of the amendments now so that we have the bill in the form that you want it to be?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would like to do that, and it is the DE3 delete all amendment that I think members have, so I would move that amendment, Mr. Chair.
Okay, the DE3 amendment has been moved by Representative Downey. All in favor of the DE3 amendment signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carried. Motion carried, and then you, that's it, right? You just have the one.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
All right. The bill is now in the form that the author has requested, so you may proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I will explain some of the differences in the DE3 as compared to the prior version. Actually, there are important changes, but I'll cover that in my presentation. And if I could, Mr. Chair, I'd like to walk through an overview of kind of the rationale behind the bill, as well as the particular features of the bill. And then entertain questions, and then obviously I'm sure there's people who might like to testify as well.
Okay.
So HF4 sets a target and says that we should be able to reduce the executive branch agency workforce 15% by 2015, so over a four-year period. And I think the immediate question that comes to mind is, why would we do that? Why would we set a target like that? And I think there's two overriding reasons and then some peripheral ones as well. The first is, if we don't do something like this, I'm pretty convinced, based on private sector experience and experience in government sector or public sector operations too, that we'll never really achieve the redesign and reform initiatives that I think we all recognize that we need. And one of the reasons is, when you set improvement goals of an incremental nature, you don't tend to change what you're doing, you just tend to change how you're doing it. And so you'll do the same things a little bit faster, a little bit cheaper, a little bit better, but you aren't really pushed or incentivized to make the substantial change, the change in what we're doing, not just how we're doing it. And it's really important to recognize that when you want to embark on some kind of a reform initiative or a redesign, consolidation, shared services, whatever it might be, you have to move people, the processes, and the technology in the same direction at the same time. And so I think that if we kind of by design don't build in the people change component of it, again, you've got one third of, you know, of the three legs of the stool that conceivably is kind of locked in place and doesn't move with you and doesn't facilitate the change. The second reason is that this is part of a broader initiative, and we're hearing another bill in government operations after this hearing that talks about a broader kind of redesign of the public sector employment model and aligning the incentives in our workforce and in their compensation structures so that they are actually incentivized to pursue these kinds of redesign and reform initiatives as compared to incentivized to kind of stay locked in place. And so it's really important, I think, to let go of the status quo and really start to position our workforce for the work that they have in the future, and not lock them in, kind of unlock their potential and give them the freedom and the employment structures that align them with these kinds of initiatives. And we'll talk about the other facets of that initiative in the next committee hearing. Big backdrop, real quick. You know, why do we need to do this? I've laid out kind of the case for change. But the broader case, actually, I think, resides in what has happened to our state budget over the last 25 years. And this chart does a 25-year look back. If you go back to our 86-87 budget year and then play that budget forward, you'll notice the blue bars are what we have actually spent out of our general fund. And the yellow bars represent what our general fund expenditures would have been had they increased at the rate of population growth and inflation. And you can see that state spending in actual dollars has far exceeded what it would have been had it grown at the rate of inflation and population growth. And you can see the dip in our current biennium where we backfilled with stimulus funds and covered some of our program commitments there through stimulus funds. Then you can see how all of that turns back on, and we don't have the stimulus funds to cover it anymore. And you can see the gap between the yellow bar and the blue bar in terms of why we have this deficit that we have. Interestingly, you look at the same picture in terms of our all funds spending. So throw in healthcare access fund, the gas tax, the highway user fund, all of the federal funds that flow through the state, and you can see that same perspective and realize that we're spending right around $60 billion. And again, had we increased at the rate of inflation and population growth, it would be substantially less than that. And frankly, members, we'd have a surplus, not a deficit, had we grown at that kind of a level. So the big backdrop is the growth in our state spending. And we saw the workforce report yesterday and had some discussion about government employment as compared to the private sector. And the two graphs at the top show on the right government employment, state government employment, and education and health, which are largely, or at least in major parts, funded by state government. And you can see that those have actually grown over the last 4 years as compared to the private sector, where we've seen significant reductions. So I think the compare and contrast here in terms of the public sector versus the private sector is really telling. And this isn't to somehow, you know, take a swipe at the public sector or somehow say that because we had this downturn in the private sector, we should have a similar downturn in the public sector, but it just does show the disparity.
Representative Downey, we have a couple of questions here. Sure. Before you go any further. Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Downey, you know, I've maintained, I hope consistently, that we have authority over the contracts that we do approve of as a legislature. Just for the record, can you tell me if this has any impact on county and city employees?
Representative Downey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Erdahl. No, it does not. And bear with me here. I'm trying to create the case for why, and then we'll talk about the particulars of the bill. But you're exactly right. This is executive branch agencies only. It specifically excludes the Minnesota State College and University system, local government, and judiciary and legislative branches as well.
Representative Kahn.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Representative Downey, a little bit of comparing apples and oranges in that chart. For example, I noticed you didn't have a health part for private employees, and you didn't have, one of the issues on construction is that clearly there's been, because of something that doesn't affect the public sector, the massive amount of foreclosures has definitely cut down the kinds of private construction. And part of, you know, I guess an economist I like and you probably don't like, but since he got the Nobel Prize, I'm more correct than you are, Paul Krugman has pointed out that it's exactly the function of government to move in with construction because construction jobs, for several very good economic reasons that you might even agree with, is that the costs are lower because people are anxious to bid on them, and the and besides that, and the interest rates are lower. Mm-hmm. So, would you like to speak to those two points,
Representative Downey?
I think you raised maybe a broader question and one that isn't really the subject of this bill necessarily, and that's Keynesian economics in our current economic downturn, and I'm not sure I want to engage in a debate on that. I know where I would lie relative to continuing to increase government expenditures and government deficits and government debt on the assumption that that will somehow create economic prosperity. But with regard to this bill, I produced those charts not as an airtight argument to say that because the private sector has suffered these job losses, that the government sector has suffered these job losses, but to paint the contrast. And in the end, I'm going to argue that there's no reason that the same kind of productivity increases and kind of sharing in that sacrifice that Minnesotans have made broadly, I think that's perfectly appropriate and frankly warranted and overdue, at least at state government. And I intentionally excluded MinSkew and the local government units because, frankly, they're ahead of the state. I've actually got the deed system online if at some point you want to go out and look at the statistics. But the MinSkew system is down a couple percentage points. Local governments are down a couple percentage points. State government seems to be the island where we haven't achieved those kinds of workforce actions and cost reduction actions. So that's really the reason for putting those slides up there as compared to a broader debate on Keynesian economic theory and columnist Krugman.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Downey, but the point was I said it would have been more meaningful if you had had parallel things. Like, for example, if you have health and education on the public level, then maybe you should have had health and education on the private level to see what's happening with that.
Oh, Mr. Chair and Representative Kahn, I'm sorry. I didn't understand your question. These categories are straight off of the deed website. So education and health are the conglomeration of public and private. I put them up there to show that they had experienced growth because so much of their growth is fueled through public expenditures.
You may proceed.
And members, I'd encourage everybody on this committee to spend a little bit of time. It's a little bit of a techie enterprise, but to go out and look at the deed website and pull up some of these tables. We saw in our workforce report how difficult it is to try and peg the count of the workforce. And out on the deed website, you can see the monthly numbers, see the seasonal swing, and then they average it on a per year basis. And it's a little hard to tell on this slide, but you can actually click down and see what percentage of the overall state of Minnesota employment figure these numbers represent. And there's some telling statistics in there. We had a discussion on Representative Anderson's question about what percentage of the workforce does state and local government represent. And if you want, we can even click into some of those spreadsheets here when we get into a deeper discussion. Another component of why we should do this is the aging demographic. Two things here. Number one, we have a pending wave of retirements, and if we hire behind those retirements, we're simply going to cement our workforce and cost structure literally for the next 30 years, which I think would not be wise. And number two, we're really imbalanced right now. We have, I think, a surplus of senior people in manager and supervisory positions. If I remember right, it might have been MAPE a year or two ago that produced some analysis showing savings that could be gained by actually rebalancing the ratio of management to staff level people, and I share that. So we have an imbalanced workforce structure as well as one that I think is probably not been tuned or right-sized enough as well. Just a recap for those who maybe weren't here for the workforce report yesterday, the total increase in state government executive branch agency employment and reflected in terms of total cost of labor. You can see the increases. Clearly, I don't think those increases have been experienced in any other sector, even if they maybe were able to hold on to their employment numbers. I don't think the compensation to those individuals has held, let alone increased at the levels that we're seeing here. There was a question in the government ops committee as to why just the executive branch agencies, and you can see that's where the people are. And I didn't feel it appropriate at this point with some of the challenges that the judiciary has to include them in this right now. That might be a matter for another committee as compared to the jurisdiction of ours here. So very focused on the executive branch agencies, and to Representative Erdahl's question, explicitly excluding anything other than executive branch agencies. We saw the retirement trends and the attrition trends in the workforce report, repeating them here because this is really important in terms of how we would actually accomplish these kinds of workforce reductions. You can see that we have a natural attrition roughly in the 1,200, 1,500 range, depending on the year and the circumstances. So to the bill then. The bill sets a goal. 15% reduction in both the headcount and the total cost of labor. And we do this, I hope, in a flexible and a strategic way, partnering with the governor by setting the timeline and the target as compared to the specifics. The bill recognizes that much of this reduction, I think, frankly, most of it, if not almost all of it, could be achieved through attrition. There's an early retirement option in the bill that is in addition to the early retirement provision that Representative Carlson had last year that's in law right now and has actually generated a good amount of early retirements. There are other bills that are talking about wage freezes, restructuring benefits. So there are a lot of tools at the governor's disposal, and I want to make sure people realize we're not trying to prescribe exactly where and when and how, but that we need to get there and trust that the governor would do it very strategically and wisely and with great care for the employees and with care for the mission of state government, but that we would get there. The early retirement program that's in the delete all is the big change from the previous bill. The previous bill had a rule of 70 kind of approach, and frankly that's a fairly expensive way to do it, and when I saw the workforce report and realized that we can probably get at least 75% of the way there, maybe even 100% of the way to this target just through attrition. Mr. Bergstrom and I met, and I really appreciate their cooperation and the good meetings that we had, and came up with a revised structure which would grant a month of service for every year of service, which would actually incentivize the more senior folks into an early retirement as compared to younger folks, and it actually costs a lot less too, and we'll see that in the fiscal note. Very importantly, we do have a hard hiring freeze, and obviously with essential employees and things, you got to work around some factors there. But the point is we can't just hire behind this attrition. And I don't know if you noticed on the workforce report, but I think in that time period we had rehired over 3,000 employees. So while we had an early retirement benefit, we kept hiring. So those two don't work really well together. And so the basic plan here is if you don't hire behind the retirees and the natural attrition, you give our executive branch agencies 4 years. They can do this very intentionally and in a well-designed way. Interestingly, other states are doing far more of this than we are, and you could argue that other states are in worse shape than we are, and that's really true. But 26 states have had actual layoffs, significant rounds of layoffs, and I'm not saying we need to be New York or California, who are really in a world of hurt. Furloughs, 22 states, salary reductions, 7 states, and we really haven't done any of that. A little bit of early retirement incentive, but none of the major actions that so many other states are embarking on. I already mentioned the difference or the kind of combination of the early retirement that Representative Carlson had last year and the one that's in here, so I won't spend any more time on that. And then to the fiscal note and the savings, and I think I've lifted this out accurately. The fiscal note is a multi-page document, and you can compare and make sure that I haven't gotten this wrong. But the savings are pretty significant numbers. Obviously, I should make a quick setup comment here. The fiscal note assumes a very gradual and kind of even approach across the 4 years to get to the target. So this is kind of peanut buttering all of those goals across the 4 years evenly. Again, how Governor Dayton would choose to implement this you know, whether it would be a steeper escalation in the out years as compared to even, I think, would remain to be seen. But again, we'd leave it to him to figure out the best way to do it. But regardless, I think the fiscal note presents a pretty fair picture of the overall benefits of doing this. And so the savings are in the first column, the cost of the early retirement and the net. So over the current biennium, you're up in the $230 million range across the 4 years of the bill where we set the target, $815 million of savings. And then annually thereafter, once the cost of the early retirement has been absorbed, you're talking about $330 to $340 million of annual savings. And members, I need to apologize. In my previous comments in committee and otherwise, I said that it was a biennial savings, and it actually is annual. It's important to note that only 32% of that workforce in the executive branch agencies are funded through general fund. So when you look at these savings in terms of what would be returned to the general fund, it's only 32% of that number, but those dollars get returned to those program areas in health and human services and transportation, et cetera. So over a 10-year period, we're talking about a fairly significant amount of savings here, $2.8 billion. So in summary, the intention of this bill is to really optimize our workforce for the future, to position it to not only respond to but actually be a force for driving all of the redesign and the reform and the savings that we want. Again, we're trying to do this in collaboration with the governor, trusting the governor, setting a target and setting the outcome, not necessarily the inputs, and knowing the governor and his character that he would do this in a responsible way and with great care for the employees and the good of our state in mind. And I would just argue, I think this is imperative. We're going to end up getting here one way or another. We are hitting a brick wall. We can't sustain the levels of spending that we have. Frankly, I think a component of that has to be the workforce, and we can get there in a humane and strategic way. Another thing that's been mentioned many times in the press and otherwise is the jobs impact, that we're cutting 5,000 jobs, and I think that's one of the mistakes of just looking at our government pie charts as isolated entities and not realizing the big picture. The reality is all of that money that funded those positions came out of the private sector in the first place, where had it been left, it would have been creating jobs and economic activity already. And so anytime we make a decision like this, it's not that jobs are lost, they're simply moving to other places. And I would ask us, while it's not the jurisdiction of our committee, but just think about the repurposing of that $2.8 billion over the next 10 years. Think about where those savings could be used and that we could fund our priorities as compared to bureaucracy, and that's not to diminish the work or the things that those people are doing. But we have other program areas that those savings could be redeployed to. And I just did some really rough math. I think the debt service that you could fund through that could probably handle a $2.8 billion bonding bill. That's rough math. It could be higher, actually. But if we use Governor Dayton's logic, and frankly I don't subscribe to it, but if we use his logic, that's 78,000 jobs. If we redeployed those savings today to a $2.8 billion bonding bill that I would vote against, but using the governor's logic, we would create 78,000 jobs. You could pay back the K-12 shift, and on top of that, redirect $1 billion to the disabled, seniors, higher ed, pick a program area. Somebody like myself, we might suggest that we leave that $2.8 billion in the private sector and see the jobs that could be created there. So I really want to stress, members, that anybody who says that this is about cutting jobs is A, misrepresenting the bill, because we're really talking about an attrition-based reduction, not a bunch of cuts. And number two, I think they're mistaking the broader impact of savings in an area like this and how those savings could be utilized. And the last statement I want to make, this bill, as it has been introduced and moved through committees, has really been attacked, and I think unfairly so. And it has been charged that we're demonizing public employees. And my challenge to those people who would make that kind of a charge is, why can't we do this in the public sector? I mean, what is it about public sector employees that would have you argue that we can't achieve the same kind of productivity gains that we do and have in the private sector all the time? And I've done a lot of projects in the public sector, and I can tell you there's nothing about public sector workers that says we can't do this. Frankly, it's about our leadership. And we have a lot of bills that will be coming through this committee, consolidating executive branch agencies, moving to administrative shared services, consolidating redundant technology, all kinds of opportunities, eligibility and enrollment, technology initiatives in human services, consolidating human services administrative functions. If we provide the legislative and executive branch leadership, I guarantee you our people can do this. And with that, Mr. Chair, I'd take questions.
Does it give you hope for change?
Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Hello. Chair. Representative Downey, do you recall or have you studied what percentage of the total state workforce is funded through the general fund versus other federal funds or other programmatic funds, dedicated funds?
Representative Downey.
Mr. Chair, Representative Winkler, yes, and I intentionally asked for the fiscal note to delineate that. There's 32% of the executive branch agency workforce that's funded through the general fund, and the rest is a mix of other funding streams.
Representative Winkler.
So, Mr. Chair, Representative Downey, so we're starting out with only 32% of total funds that are even eligible for this kind of reduction. I mean, we can't reduce a federal program and repurpose that money for the bonding bill. That probably would invite, you know, a negative view from some federal auditors, potentially. Isn't that right?
Representative Downey?
Mr. Chair and Representative Winkler, the savings and reductions can be realized irrespective of the funding streams. It's just to what fund do those savings get returned to? And in this particular case, the estimates that I did on the debt service required to service the payments on GO bonds was based explicitly on the savings returned to the general fund.
Mr. Chair, then let's look. I mean, I think we had this in the workforce report yesterday. 85% of all general fund, I think it's all general fund, general fund funded employees are in DNR, human services, and MnDOT. I think that's, is that the number you recall?
Representative Downey?
Mr. Chair, I don't recall a number. Clearly, this initiative is setting a target and allowing the governor to strategically get there and allocate the savings across the agencies as he sees fit, and where the natural attrition and the natural savings are going to come from, and where the executive branch and legislative initiatives drive efficiencies.
Well,
Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, if you look at the workforce report, it's 82% come from 10 agencies, with the lion's share being human services, transportation, corrections, DNR. And what the workforce report also said is that all those agencies have seen reductions in FTEs. The only agencies that have seen any significant growth have been public safety, corrections, and veterans. So if you actually take out those areas that have been the sacred cows, Governor Pawlenty certainly designated them as sacred cows, and there was a certain bipartisan agreement, at least on veterans. I don't think that was quite so bipartisan on corrections. But if you take those sacred cows out, we've seen reductions. And do you have any, we had this bill yesterday. It started out as a $200 million cut, and then it went to conference, and it came back with 16 things that couldn't be cut suddenly, and it got shrunk to a $100 million cut in this biennium. And so when this bill finally comes out, are we going to avoid having those sacred cows and focus all the cuts in those other service areas? Or how are we going to ensure that that actually makes it through the political process without just concentrating all the cuts in unpopular areas?
Representative Downey?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Representative Winkler, I guess from my perspective, the time for sacred cows is past. And having done some work in a lot of the agencies that you've referenced, I can tell you there's ample room for restructuring, redesign across all units of government. And again, I think there would be a long-term, four-year legislative and executive branch, hopefully collaboration, to figure out where the best places are, to find the opportunities to make those reductions. And I'm confident, even just with the bills that we're introducing this year, that a lot of the reductions in the savings that we've already projected for years one and two are possible. So I keep hearing why we can't do this. I keep hearing how we can't do this, how we have to protect this and that. And you know what? Every single family, every single business across the state of Minnesota has figured out a way how to do this. And I'm guessing they didn't have sacred cows, and we can't either. So I'm not saying this is easy. I'm not saying this is a pass this bill and we're automatically there kind of activity. But I am saying that if we don't set this kind of a target, whether it's literally by just cutting appropriations and forcing the kind of work that we're talking about simply by not giving these organizations the money, and if we don't do one of these two things, just assuming that we can keep on going the way we are, it's just not going to work. So I would defend this bill irrespective of the challenges and the hard work that we and the governor would have ahead of ourselves.
Mr. Chair, Representative Downey, why wouldn't we just do this through the regular committee process? Why not have the people who serve, if you want to cut human services, the nurses that we have in human services, the people who work with sex offenders at Moose Lake, if you want to cut all those people, why not work through the committee process to do that? Why wouldn't the legislature want to be involved in deciding on the front end where the 15% cut comes from? We have obviously a different governor in power than we did 2 years ago, but I personally still think the legislature is the place where you sort out where cuts should be, what the impact is going to be. You take public testimony. There's a check and balance in the legislative process that allows us to weigh and sort out these things. Why would we just tell the governor, go figure it out, and then realize the savings where you want to realize the savings and come back? Why wouldn't we do the work?
Representative Downey.
Mr. Chair and members, I'd suggest that we have been doing the work, and for the last 25 years, state government has grown twice the rate of the rest of the economy. So I think a tool and a new incentive is absolutely required.
But Representative Downey, state government may, the total spending in Minnesota may have outpaced economic growth, but if you actually look at personal income, it hasn't. It's actually been reduced in recent years. But that hasn't been due to public employees. So if you're concerned about total spending, you reduce appropriations. If you're worried about optimizing your workforce, you wouldn't come up with a 15% number that you said in the last committee was just sounded like a good number. I guess it's not clear to me what we're trying to accomplish. If you want to save money, reduce appropriations, reduce services. Why do you want to focus on the employees who have actually been flat while total spending has gone up? And by the way, we just said we had this testimony yesterday. Minnesota is actually a very well-run state, tightly managed. We have few employees per capita. We're one of the best states for that. I think that's because of our, we're a common-sense, practical, upper Midwestern state, and we've got a good pension system. We're well-managed overall. So why go after that particular segment? Why the workforce when we could save money by reducing appropriations and just reducing services?
Representative Winkler, is there a question there?
Yeah,
or
why?
That a speech?
No, it was a question, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
The question is, what are you trying to accomplish? If you're trying to save money, reduce appropriations, and cut services, why target workers who haven't been the problem to the extent there even has been a problem, which I would dispute? But why target the workers?
Representative Downey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Representative Winkler, I actually agree with you that all facets of this need to be dealt with. I mean, clearly the majority, vast majority in certain program areas of our state spending is in pass-through program expenditures either out to local units of government or directly to recipients. So we absolutely have to address that, and I think we will. But to sit here and think that we're going to somehow resolve a $6.2 billion budget deficit without looking at everything is myopic, and I don't know how, even if you go after the appropriation side of it, you don't end up having the employees who are a huge part of our overall operational component of state government, you don't go after that. And I know we had this discussion in government operations too. Well, this is only 15% of 15%, and I don't think that's true. But maybe for some people, $340 million a year isn't much money. But I'll tell you what, to the people that I talk with, $340 million a year sounds like an awful lot. And when you think about what we could do in terms of funding our priorities, instead of funding the back office, instead of funding the operations that go on down here in St. Paul and the executive branch agencies, I think the imperative for this kind of an incentive is pretty obvious, and I stand by the merits of the bill as an extra incentive to get there. And if we don't have this, I think history has proven we won't get there.
Mr. Chair, I will just make a final comment. $340 million is a lot of money. It's a lot of money, and it's a lot of cut in public services. This is, state employees are not just bureaucrats sitting in office buildings in St. Paul. A huge percentage of these people are actually providing direct services, corrections, human services, the DNR, MnDOT. I was rear-ended on 394 last night. Three state employees came over, made sure that the people who were in the crash were safe. They moved traffic over so that it kept flowing. The whole thing was done in about 10 minutes. And they didn't just help the people who were injured. They kept traffic flowing on the main artery on 394. These are real services. $340 million is a lot of money. And to pretend that it's just going to be cutting clerks sitting in an office typing on antiquated typewriters is really disingenuous.
Representative Lilly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Downey. This bill just fascinates me. I'm not a fancy guy, so it just $340 million is a lot of money, and I get that. But I'm starting my fourth term, and you kind of watch cycles. My first term, we were in the minority, then a majority, now the minority. But the governor, I served with plenty, and so you've seen staff and folks come and go. And if you watch the cycle now, we have a new governor, and it just, I mean, not to, I just can't help but to be a little bit of a smart aleck. I just, so many of the people that are really fighting for their jobs right now to stay in administration, quite honestly, are Republicans. And so your side of the aisle, which, $340 million sounds like a lot, but I think that's about what you guys spend in Edina on your hockey program. And still can't beat my Hill Murray, but keep trying. I don't want to name names and, stuff like that, but we know who they are, folks that have been in our seats as legislators and have maybe lost or whatever, had transitions in their lives and chosen to be picked up by the Plenty administration, and then now want to stay on. Or, the other day I saw you sitting by a guy that was, worked for the Free Market Institute, and now he works for the House, making $55,874.88, and hates government. I just have a hard time just not being a smarty about this. It's just, how they hate government at one point, but then want these jobs. So I just don't understand. Have you seen what's happened the last few years too? And with the administration, they've changed classifications on many of these jobs. So people that were used to be unclassified, through my hockey buddy Plenty, we're friends. But he, many of the people change classifications from classified to, or unclassified to classified so they can stay on. And so I just really have a hard time. And I know I believe that your intent is pure or whatever, but I just, I know these people. I mean, I've seen it, and these are real people. And quite honestly, and I'm not saying it doesn't happen on our side of the aisle, but I've seen it on your side. I just don't understand, the reality. And I wish you'd go after that to some extent and just, have a pure heart. So I guess as an average guy, it just seems, it's hard for me not to be sarcastic. I guess my question would be, as the chair said, that rest has been statements and challenges, perhaps, you know, for all of us to be, you know, consistent with what we do and say, I guess, as our parents would teach us. I guess my question would be, a couple of years ago, did you support the cuts to political appointees, Mr. Downey?
Representative Downey?
Mr. Chair and Representative Lilly, I'm not sure exactly what bill you're referring to. I do remember Representative Sertich having a bill before this committee that very intentionally went after management layers and political appointees, if I remember the scope of it, and I did vote for that. And maybe a broader answer to your question, again, I have no sacred cows, and I can't speak to what you're describing in the executive branch under the previous governor. But clearly, we have an imbalanced workforce where senior people, many of them in appointed positions as compared to the staff and union-type positions, would bear, I think, the brunt of what we're talking about. And when we talk about the brunt of this, and you talked about trying to put a human face on this, and I totally agree with you. But again, by design, this program is not just cutting 5,000 people from their jobs. This is saying over a four-year period, leveraging natural attrition, early retirements, if that's what we need to get to the target, to allow people who are voluntarily making this decision to do so. So, I think it's really important to, you know, on the one hand, I actually probably would agree with almost all of your comments, minus the one about the Hillary hockey program. But
fair enough.
And I think I would agree with your comments. I mean, all of this has a human face. And, you know, I know people that spent down their own personal savings, went through personal bankruptcy to keep their people employed as long as they possibly could in the private sector. And you say, as a common guy, some of what you see doesn't make sense, and I agree with you. And I can tell you, as a basic guy who just came down here with a business background, I agree. And when I look at this chart and realize the decimation that has occurred in the private sector, and then the natural spilling over of the revenue, the public sector revenue impact of that, and know what's happened on my block and every person in this room's block in terms of people losing their jobs, figuring out how they do without a vacation, selling their homes, downsizing, all the stuff that's going on, and it doesn't matter whether it's Representative Hayden's community or mine. Different size and shape maybe, but the impacts are everywhere. And it, I think, to the average common man, doesn't make sense that the only place that that hasn't occurred, that that effect hasn't been felt and real work hasn't been done to kind of right-size with economic reality, is right here in St. Paul in the core of state government. And we've talked a lot about local governments. You know, local governments are ahead of us. They're freezing. They're furloughing. They're laying people off. They're going into shared services. They're doing all kinds of stuff. The Minnesota State Colleges and Universities system is the only organization, if I remember looking back over the, whatever it is, 12, 16, 18 bargaining units, that really, truly had a freeze or a cut. And so our state colleges and universities are ahead of us. So I just think, and I don't want to turn this into a G, you know, everyone's in trouble, so we should be. I mean, this should have merit on the face of it, not just because of in comparison to other components of society, but boy, it really does stand out as a common person just looking at this. Why in the world is the core of state government the only place in the state that hasn't experienced this yet?
Mr. Chair and Representative Downey, I guess just kind of closing, I mean, I hear what you're saying. I wish kind of what Representative Winkler said, I just would be more comfortable. You know, I'm not saying I'm against the cuts at times, and, you know, I have supported them. I voted for them the last couple of years, and I would imagine the cycle, we I will again. But why wouldn't you want to have more control over areas and I guess that's, again, probably a comment, you know, and control the budgets and cut in certain areas, just kind of instead of a big swipe of the bat. And, you know, it's interesting, in my experience here, I served with Representative Lanning on the Subcommittee on Employee Relations. Well, we had a case, and I think I mentioned it before, where we had, you know, people that were controlling our investment board. And to be competitive, you know, we chose as a committee and supported, rather, that, you know, we would give these folks a pay increase. And, you know, just my personal family, my wife is in the private sector, and she just experienced the same thing, which, you know, is quite nice, actually. She quadrupled her wage. So I'm going to suffer through that. But, you know, meanwhile, at Delta, we've taken a pay cut. So, I mean, it's, you know, I don't think you can just do things. I don't think that is what happens in the free market system out there. You just don't make cuts. You cut and add and, you know, based on a competitive market. So I think your thought is, I just don't know how it succeeds perfectly. I just can't quite figure it out. But thank you.
Members, we have about seven other members who have questions. At some point here, I want to open it up to anyone in the audience who wishes to be heard either for or against this bill. So we'll keep going down the list here, but please know that we need to open this up at some point, too. Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll actually defer to people in the audience. I think it's more important that they talk than I talk right now. As long as I can at the end, maybe ask a couple questions. But
sure.
I'm happy to defer to the audience members if they want to.
Okay. The others on the list. Representative Murphy?
I would like a couple clarifications.
Okay. Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Representative Mr. Chair and Representative Downey. In your remarks, you talked about working with the governor's staff. Was that in depth, or was that a particular person, or just casual meetings?
Representative Downey?
Mr. Chair and Representative Murphy, I think my comment was probably more directed to the fact that we would achieve this over a four-year period. And so there are four legislative sessions in which the legislature and the executive branch can work on the appropriation and legislative agenda to accomplish this. But to your more immediate point, yes, we've had a couple of discussions around specific initiatives, one of which Representative Kahn and I are going to be working on together, the consolidation of the some of the redundant technology enterprise into a shared service function for that. And then other discussions as well with the governor's office that are in a very preliminary stage, given the fact that they are obviously consumed with preparing their budget at this point.
And
Representative Murphy?
Mr. Chair, we're talking about the new governor and the new staff.
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, yes.
And then could you tell me how the full-time equivalents and the vacancies of the full-time equivalents that stand today were calculated into your charts and graphs?
Representative Downey?
Mr. Chair and Representative Murphy, I utilized exclusively the headcount, the workforce information from the Department of Employment and Economic Development and the workforce report.
Okay. Representative Murphy.
And Mr. Chair, Representative Downey, do you think that that was... No, I'll accept that. I just... The past several years I've been confused with budget books and the full-time equivalency and how many vacancies and how much vacancies were not filled, and so the money was carried and used to fill other things in the budgets, and that was confusing to me then, and it's still confused But I imagine Deed, you used their figures, and I imagine Deed was using what was in the budget books, which confused me for years.
Mr. Chair, if I could...
Representative Downey.
Point of information, I agree. I was confused for a long time, and until I actually poked down into the drill-down spreadsheets that are available on the Department of Employment and Economic Development website, I didn't really understand that, and I think there's a couple of things to note when you do that. One is this difference between full-time equivalents and actual kind of per-head counts during the course of the year. And then the second is the terminology state government, for example, out on the Deed website includes MNSCU and executive branch and judicial. See, you really got to be careful to make sure you're dealing with apples to apples on all of this data. So I echo your comment about it being complicated.
And then,
Representative Murphy?
Mr. Chair, Representative Downey, is someone going to testify then on the impact of the early retirement on the liabilities of the Pension Commission?
Mr. Bertram is here.
Pension plans?
Excuse me, Mr. Chair.
Representative Downey?
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, Mr. Bergstrom is here. I assume he'd be willing, if he wasn't already planning, to come down. And again, I appreciate him working with me to come up with a well-structured approach to the early retirement component of this.
Because, Mr. Chair, Representative Downey, sometimes people are very interested in early retirement plans and how will it affect their life, but they're not as interested in how will it affect the lives of all the people that are in the plan, and especially as the lives continue on. It's the age of or the numbers of years that people are on retirement have been growing considerably, and that has a financial impact on the plans.
Mr. Chair,
I'd like to hear a little bit about how your plan is going to affect those numbers.
Mr. Chair, very briefly, the bill actually does require an actuarial analysis to be done to determine the exact impact on the pensions, and the first dollar of savings generated from the workforce reductions goes back to making the pensions whole relative to where they are currently. It will not put them in an underfunded position any more than they currently are.
Thank you for that clarification. That's so the money from the $2.8 billion savings then would go for their share of the first amount would go to the pension committees, or pension plans, I mean.
Representative Downey?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Representative Murphy, yes, and I just pulled the slide up here, and it shows the cost of that early retirement in terms of the first dollars that would go back to the pensions. It's a total of about $11 million, and I don't know if Mr. Bergstrom wants to come down now or we just wait till later, but he can cover that in more detail.
Thanks for those clarifications. Thank you.
Representative Slawick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick point and a question is, you know, Representative Downey, I think intuitively we all know we're in tough times and that we're going to have to do something. The question is, how do you do it? And I do see that the governor has hired a new person to come in. You've seen from another state. He's going to be coming in for the Department of Administration. Just like there's all these bills on permitting, but the governor did his executive order, I think that there will be something at the administrative level that we can, administration level, that we can do about this. I just want to remind you that government is not the private sector. When there are tough times, you know, I've served on Human Services Finance Committee for 7 terms now. The demand for human services goes up. Mm-hmm. When people don't have jobs and they can't get food and they lose their homes, that's when the safety net does kick in. We may not like that. We may not think that that's what government is there for, but that is the truth, is services are in higher demand during difficult times, especially in human services. And if you're going to if you're going to go with attrition in the human services, which is the biggest department, are you going to contract out for that work, or is that work just not going to happen? You know, we've had numerous issues. I've had constituents call up with lots of problems in the Department of Human Services because there are not a lot of staff that are left there. There has been some attrition. There are numerous issues around the healthcare issues that are happening there. It takes weeks to straighten out. So what is your plan for when there's reductions? Are you going to contract out, and then would you then put a limit on the amount that could be contracted out, or the work is just going to go away, or what's going to happen?
Representative Downey.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Slawik, a couple of thoughts in reply to your comment and question. Number one, I'm not sure that I totally agree that state government can somehow remain immune from the economic realities on the premise that somehow everything we do here is absolutely necessary, and I think that's a big part of what we'll debate about what are our priorities. Secondly, this bill is all about funding our priorities and I'll say not overhead or not wasteful things, and so it very intentionally forces us to think about priorities and making sure that we are focused on the program side of it and the service to people. But maybe more directly to your question about human services, for example, so initiatives that are currently in discussion include putting up an automated eligibility and enrollment system, and if you looked at the number of people, not just in state government, but in county governments that manage just the intake function, eligibility determination and enrollment, it is a huge number of folks. And if we could put in some of the automated tools that are in place, Pennsylvania and Wisconsin, for example, just put in systems that are potentially available through public domain, we could actually serve people a lot better and achieve these kinds of targets. If we don't set these kind of targets, I question whether we'd really ever pursue those things. We're kind of locked into a workforce structure that might even preclude us from thinking about it. There's another idea from Lutheran Social Services about finding a way to aggregate all the disability funding streams and do it in a consumer-directed, put those funds available to the disabled person and their caregivers through consumer-directed plans, almost a voucher-like model. And you think about the potential of that for reducing, kind of back-office control mechanisms and all the program administration functions. So I think there's tons of great ideas all over the place, and none of them, kind of by definition, at least from what I've seen, absolutely necessitates somehow cutting benefits and cutting the very important things that we do. So I think your point is well taken. I might disagree with a little bit of the premise, but this is all about continuing to drive ourselves to find those opportunities and work together on them. And I know the governor's office is very focused on these things. The handful of conversations I've had with those folks, I think we got a really fertile ground for this session and next to make progress on those things.
Very briefly, Mr. Chair, if we would do a new computer system for eligibility, I mean, I think we all really want that. It's really expensive. But if we could do that, I think, some of those trade-offs, if they are on the table and we would spend the money, would make sense.
Representative Downey, I would like to move to hearing from folks in the audience who may wish to speak either for or against this bill. We'll come back to the list of members who have further questions or comments. So at this point, is there anyone in the audience who wishes to be heard? I understand that Mr. Hudap. Welcome to the committee. If you would please identify yourself for the tape.
Good morning, sir. My name is Matthew Hudap. I'm the president of the Minnesota State Troopers Association. Mr. Chair and members, over the years, the State Patrol and the Troopers Association has come to you with an issue of our staffing levels, where our staffing levels pale by comparison to other states. We currently rank in the 47th to 48th, depending on per million miles traveled, population-based licensed motor vehicles and registered or licensed drivers and registered motor vehicles. Over the years, we have inched up with our staffing levels within the State Patrol to the point where we're just under 600 state troopers from the colonel on down. This bill here 15% reduction in the workforce would cut 90 troopers out of all of our districts, all across the state. And currently, we are in what I would call a reactionary mode, where we're just handling crashes and taking care of business as best we can. But I believe that this bill, on the face of it, would impact the State Patrol dramatically. I also think that in looking at the initiatives of both the U.S. Chamber of Commerce and the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce, part of their push, if you look at their agendas over the last couple of years, is to try to attack or go after public employees. And to me, that's appalling that they're trying to pull us down to a level of what they're providing services, whether it's health care or benefits, that type of thing. Some of the bigger employers aren't even providing, such as Walmart's and some of these others. And the correlation between a private and a public employee, oftentimes over the years, the public employee's salary range and benefits is not been kept up with the private sector. Maybe those two are starting to come together, but the mere fact that we do have a both an employer and employee run healthcare system, which is running very efficiently, that's a benefit that I believe is being looked at, and as well as being attacked under this bill. So I would be opposed to this legislation, either in the constitutional amendment form or in a standalone bill. I'd stand for any questions.
Well, thank you, Mr. Hodep, for coming forward. Representative Leidiger, you had a question?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Hodep, approximately how many employees, troopers, do we have like 30 years ago?
30 years ago, we were probably in, when I first came on, which is 1982, and so we're talking 29 years ago, we were at a full strength of about 535. And that's from the colonel down. And today, we're below 600 yet.
Representative Leiter.
Here's my question. Over the past 30 years, there has been a number of technological advancements. Call them force multipliers, that I know has happened in the Department of Defense, and I know where we cut from about 2 million to about 1.2 million due predominantly to those force multipliers. How do you, in coming up with the right sizing of the numbers of troopers that you need, how do you factor in that? I know that today there's computers in all the cars, there's everybody's got cell phones, so that's that instantaneous communication. I don't think we're relying just on radio. So how do you account for that to get to a right-sized force?
Mr. Chair,
Mr. Hoda,
Representative Leidiger, those are all very good points. The automation or the technological changes that we've occurred have occurred in my 29 years, huge, absolutely huge. I just recently, within the last year and a half, got a computer in my squad car. The computers are rolled out across the state. Everyone's got a laptop in their car, and that does assist. We still are, there's a pilot project currently going on for automated ticket writing, where they'll be able to just swipe the driver's license. That'll populate the field and it'll move things along quicker. With technology, as we all know, as you get a cell phone, it was supposed to make our lives easier, but it hasn't. You're on the phone nonstop all the time. In fact, across the state, troopers do not have state-issued cell phones, unless they're in the metropolitan area where they finally had the funding and provided the cell phones for troopers out in the field. So we do not have cell phones across the entire state yet. automation is great. Technology is wonderful. Some of us old fellows maybe don't quite pick up on it as well as the younger folks. Right. But and I believe that's being factored in by management as far as assisting in that. I could get you an answer to that. I know what they've looked at in the past. It was called a PAM model, police allocation model. And in looking at other like states and sizes of their departments, of their staffing levels out in the field, when you have calls for service, you have crashes, you have stalled vehicles, you have any myriad of different things that go on our state highways, when we look at the current count of our numbers to our licensed drivers has gone up threefold, I believe, since I came on the job 29 years ago. The amount of registered vehicles has gone up fourfold, and yet our number of troopers out here has diminished significantly. We've gone up a little bit, but not comparison to the amount of registered vehicles and the amount of licensed drivers we have out here. So I would imagine somebody that's very statistically savvy could figure out how does this help our job and streamline it. And we've moved into the current century. When my dad came on in 1957 on the state patrol, he retired in 1991. They didn't. I always get them. They had horses and buggies back then. So we're keeping abreast of the current technologies, but there's still the with this many vehicles out here, we still have just as many crashes, if not more. Our fatality count is down. I believe that's due to the good work of the state troopers across the state, as well as to technology. The cars of today versus 50 years ago are far superior. They can take the crash impact. They had a deal last year with a 1959 brand new, I believe it was a Ford product, against a 2009 Ford product. They crashed the two together with the dummies on the inside, and the 09, the dummy walked away with a scratch on its knee from the airbag blowing. The 59, the dummy was killed instantly. So a lot of that has helped us. Technology is wonderful, but the boots on the street, if we were to decrease by 90, boy, I tell you what, I'd hate to see what the highways look like.
Thank you.
Yes, sir.
Thank you.
Question to the testifier, Representative Gauthier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Hodapp, you kind of answered my question. Talk about threefold increase of cars on the road, fourfold driver's license. 30 years, we have a million more people. We have 1,000 miles of highway that's deemed in poor condition by the Department of Transportation. So when we're looking at that per cost, I mean, you guys are doing a lot more with a lot less. And so if we're comparing, what we're really doing is a massive reduction under this bill to the highway patrol. Would you agree with that?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Mr. Hodapp.
Yes, absolutely. We're 15% staffing cut. We're not only talking to the state patrol, but also to the clerical staff, to the dispatchers, to everything. That would be a massive cut.
If I can follow up, would it be safe to assume that poor roads, as labeled by DOT, contribute to accidents?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gauthier.
Mr. Hodapp.
Yes, they can. Absolutely, they can.
Thank you, Mr. Hodapp.
Yes, sir.
Representative Winkler. Okay. Thank you very much, Mr. Hodapp, appreciate your being here today. Next testifier. Please identify yourself for the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I'm Julie Blyle, Legislative Director for AFSCME Council 5. To go on record in opposition of the bill that's before you and any bill that interferes with the collective bargaining process that is put in place in PELRA and state statute. And I think it bears repeating some of the statistics that Elliot Side made before this committee. And I think they bear repeating because there's been a lot of false information that's been given out with regard to the state employee workforce. Minnesota's state workforce is the 10th leanest, and it's one of the most productive in the nation. Minnesota has 71 public workers for every 10,000 residents, and that's according to the United States Census Bureau. We're tied with conservative Florida. We're working harder with fewer workers. It's indicated, and comments have been made, that there haven't been layoffs. State employees haven't been cut. It's simply not true. Since 2002, Governor Plenty has cut 11% of the state workforce. The impact back to AFSCME alone was 1,590 members that lost their jobs. In fact, if former Governor Plenty had fired all of the state employees, the cost savings would have been erased by only 21% of the state's, and would have erased only 21% of the state's $6.2 million budget deficit. Experts agree that making state government more efficient will cut costs by only 2% at most. It's still worth the effort, because taxpayers deserve the best possible government services for their hard-earned dollars. Frontline workers know how to do that best, and the process that's laid out before you in PELRA allows for efficiencies and it allows for streamlining. Representative Slawick indicated that during times of a recession, people need government services. This bill takes a lop of 15% off the state workforce without analyzing the need for those public services and the individuals that are going to be impacted by them. Whether that's nursing home residents, whether that's people in home health care in their homes, whether that's people in assisted living that home health care goes in to make sure that they take their medications, whether that's individuals in state-operated services that are dependent on those state workers to be able to get out of bed in the morning, to be able to get their medications, to be able to function in society. The state patrol was just before you. I'll just indicate, I came in from Wilmer Monday evening. The roads in the state and the rural areas are very, very bad. Not because the public workers haven't been trying to keep those roads clean, but because we've had a tremendous amount of snow and a very difficult winter. I was driving slow. I was driving slow because there were icy patches on the road. I was pulled over. Why was I pulled over? Because one of the indications of driving slow may be that you were driving impaired. At first, my reaction was, I'm not happy about this. Then I thought about it. I was happy he pulled me over, because if I would have been driving impaired, I would have been taken off the road, and rather than endangering someone's lives. And each one of the decisions that you make, whether that be the bill before you today or the individual cuts that come before you, I want you to think of the individual lives that are impacted, whether that be the person in the nursing home, an individual in the hospital, someone out driving on a road, someone trying to go on to higher education. When there's a recession, more people go back to higher education. They go back for retraining. That increases the cost to the systems, whether that be Minsky or the University of Minnesota. Every one of these decisions has an impact. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you. Questions from committee members? Representative Banyan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Was she going to stay for questions, or?
Yes. Would you please come back if there's a question?
And I have to apologize. I didn't get your name before. Would you please?
Julie Blyle.
Blyle. Okay. Thank you, Ms. Blyle. If someone is laid off and then comes back to work, is laid off a second time and comes back to work, how many layoffs is that?
Ms. Blyle?
Mr. Chairman, according to the description that you described, that would be one layoff, but there'd be, or two layoffs, but that'd be one individual impacted. But, Mr. Chairman, you got to also remember that that's happened, particularly in our regional treatment center employees and the employees in state-operated services. Because as that person comes back and bumps someone else, it means someone else is going to be laid off. But when I gave you the numbers here of our members, I'm talking about actual individuals that no longer have a job.
So the 1590 number, excuse me, Mr. Chairman, thank you. The 1590 number you cited is actually 1590 people who had a job, were laid off, and have never been reattached to a government agency.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Banyan,
Ms. Blyle?
Yes.
Okay.
Representative Banyan.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Blyle, the data that Representative Downey presented to us earlier from the Minnesota Workforce Table from Deed cites in 2002, 88,976 government employees on average. I won't read you the whole list. 2006, 95,389. 2009, 99,018. Is it fair to say that the number of workers that are working in state government has gone up with these numbers? And how does the layoff figures come into play with that?
Ms. Pyle?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Banyan, you have to be comparing apples to apples, and I don't know what the number count was that was done on the Deed website. I'm talking about state workforce per se, and I'm not sure if they're including the University of Minnesota or other segments of government, so I can't compare the two before you today.
Mr. Chairman, Ms. Blyle, yesterday we heard from the workforce report, and it had numbers that reported small increases, small decreases, but roughly looking just at executive branch, okay, which is not everything that's in here, about 33,000. It was roughly constant, as we heard testimony to this effect yesterday. So in that context, how am I to appreciate the 1590 number that you cited?
Ms. Pyle?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Banyan, that's where I cannot say per se within what agencies these folks were. I can tell you what our membership has been decreased by. And if we take a look, there have been areas that have been hit significantly hard. There have been programs that have been shut down. There are other areas that, because of the recession, there were employees that were added. That's why the process that I talk about with regard to PELRA, the process that I talk about with regard to working together with the administration to determine where the needs for the state workforce is, a process that should take place, not just a whack of 15% off the top.
Mr. Chairman, Ms.
Representative Banyan.
Thank you. Ms. Blyle, if a worker retires and the state chooses not to replace that worker, what is the violation of PELRA that arises?
Ms. Blyle?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Banyan, there's not a violation of PELRA.
Mr. Chairman,
Representative Banyan.
Ms. Blyle, we got a report. In yesterday's report, we got a figure that the attrition rate in the state workforce was approximately 7%. Over a four-year period, 7 times 4 is 28. This bill calls for a 15% decrease. So what is I'm having trouble figuring out where this problem is that you're seeing. This anticipates simply we're not going to replace 15 out of the 28% that would retire based on the bill. Do you see a problem here?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Banyan, yes, I do, because that decision should be made by the individual agencies. And again, just mandating that if someone retires, there are areas where there are needs. With the retirements that we've seen, and because of lack of funding, in some of those areas people haven't been replaced, but we have also hit a huge drain with regard to knowledge in individual areas because there's not a lot of depth. When they do need to replace someone into that position, there may not be someone that is trained. There are positions that do need to be replaced.
Mr. Chairman, Ms. Blyle, there'll be 13% of the 28 that will be replaced. Do you believe that AFSCME employees are more productive now than they were 10 years ago?
Mr. Chairman, Pyle? Representative Banyan, technology has aided in productivity, and with regard to an individual employee, in many cases they're doing the job of what more employees did in the past because they have been forced to do that.
And Mr. Chairman, I'll end because I know other people want to talk. Do you think that's true in the private sector too?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bannion. Yes, I do believe that's true in the private sector.
And I think that's the point.
Thank you, Ms. Blyle, for being with us. And,
Mr. Chairman,
appreciate you being here.
I want to make one more comment. With regard to the services that come back and the needs that the public government, whether that be the state government or federal government, with the services that they provide, they don't make decisions as to regard to the number of individuals that are going to need those programs. And that's something that we all know. Everyone sitting around the table, everyone in the room knows. When the demand is great, you need to provide those services.
Mr. Chairman, Ms. Blyle.
And Bannion, we need to move on.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Thank you, Ms. Blyle. Others who wish to be heard, either for or against this bill?
Mr. Chair, members, thank you. I'm Richard Kajewski, the Legislative Affairs Director for the Minnesota Association of the Professional Employees. In my capacity, I represent 13,000 state professional, degreed, and non-supervisory employees. And I won't repeat the testimony of Ms. Blyle, who just testified before you, but I will emphasize what Representative Winkler previously said, that 32% of state employees are funded through the general fund. And if you look at this bill, it actually cuts 5,250 state employees' jobs, and I can assure you that when you take a look at the federal funding that's flowing through for state jobs, it's about 4% of our general fund is used to pay for these state employees and their contracts. You are going to cut vital services to the citizens of the state of Minnesota, without a question. Those include people who are taking care of your veterans in the veterans' homes, people who are providing security at the security hospitals and programs for those patients, people who are providing security and programs in the correctional facilities for those folks. These are people in the BCA labs providing testing that's backlogged, people over at the Department of Health providing testing, people keeping your lakes stocked. And I think most importantly, these are the people who provide the job services to the unemployed in the state of Minnesota. And there is not an excess of any one of those jobs in the state of Minnesota. And those are just a few of them, but those are some of the essential services that are going to be cut through this bill. By not, and we are adamantly opposed by not sending it back to the divisions where it belongs so the public can understand what services you're actually going to cut that they care about, because they are going to be vital services. With that, I'll stand for any questions. I'd like to add one more thing, Mr. Chair. Through the early retirement incentive, MMB estimates that 900 people are going to have already accepted the early retirement. MnDOT over 400, DNR over 100. State agencies have done what they can to make some of these cuts happen. Most of those positions won't be backfilled. Some of the increased employment in the state of Minnesota as a result of the federal stimulus money, those jobs are going away. So it's not higher, higher, higher. And I will to emphasize what Representative Downey said. We did propose cutting some of the management figures and getting it in line with the private sector. We did propose budget-saving ideas. Representative Sertich carried the bill. Representative Kahn had some budget-saving ideas in her bill last session that actually were included when it was signed by the governor. So with that, if anybody's got any questions.
Thank you. Any questions? Thank you. Others who wish to be heard? Mr. Bergstrom.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. My name is Dave Bergstrom, and I'm the director of the Minnesota State Retirement System. And I just want to talk about the pension piece in this. We do not, MSRS does not have a position on the bill itself. My focus is making sure that the state retirement system plan remains funded. I do want to thank Representative Downey. I did meet with him, and he has addressed my funding concerns in this bill. First of all, the proposal that you have in front of you is considerably less expensive than the original bill, probably about one-fifth of the cost. And it also allows MSRS to receive back within 1 year the full actuarial value of the cost of these additional benefits. So the agencies are going to have to pay back the Minnesota State Retirement System the additional cost. And I just wanted to comment so that people were aware that from MSRS's standpoint, the funding is provided for in this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Bergstrom. Any questions for him? Representative Leidiger.
Yes, sir. Just one question is, I remember on one of the slides, and I think that was one of your slides, is that true that one out of eight Minnesotans are receiving or going to receive a pension? Yeah, I mean, it was some large number, 640,000.
Mr. Chair, it's one out of 10.
Bergstrom?
One out of 10 have participation either as a retiree or an active member in our program.
And how does that compare again then to the rest of the nation? I mean, to me, it just seems huge.
Mr. Bergstrom?
Mr. Chair, Representative Leidiger, I am not sure how it compares to the rest of the nation. I can try to find those statistics for you.
Representative Simon.
Thank you. I can't resist adding, though, that includes all of us as well.
Yeah.
So we're all part of that one in ten.
And Mr. Chair, to that point, it includes teachers and public employees. It was not just state employees. It was local government and teachers, et cetera. So.
Yeah, I get a Navy pension.
Thank you, Mr. Bergstrom. Anyone else who wishes to be heard? Do you have a question, Representative Hayden?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I have more of a statement. I mean, there's been great questions today. I think a couple of things that have come up for me today is, and first of all, I want to thank
Representative Hayden. I wanted to make sure that we've given an opportunity,
sure,
and anyone
yes,
who
sir.
Wishes to testify either for or against. Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to come before us either for or against this bill? If not, I need to move back to our list, and you're on the list, Representative Hayden, and we will get to you. We'll go back to the list of members who we have. Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Since it's fresh in our minds from yesterday, I just want to repeat a couple of things that were in the workforce report. First of all, we have fewer actual numbers of employees than we do 10 years ago, period. That's a fact. Fewer than we do 10 years ago. So I don't think it's fair to say or imply that it's sort of a bloated or out-of-control state workforce. I just think the facts don't bear that out. Secondly, the report also says that the overall increase in the dollars that we're spending for that roughly same number of employees, actually slightly fewer, is due in large part to rising health care costs and to legislatively mandated retirement benefit contributions. And Representative Murphy might know more about that than any of us, or Representative Kahn. So I think we've got to put this in perspective. Representative Downey, it seems to me that I know your intentions are good with this, and you've done a lot of work with this, but it's sort of a moving target as to what your rationale is. On the one hand, you're talking in sweeping terms about state government out of control and implying at least that this is part of the solution to that, that this would help us be back in control. At other points, you imply that it would be a wash in terms of spending because we would just repurpose the dollars to something else. I know you say you don't support a big bonding bill, but you use the example of how this might just be spent on some other government expenditure. And at other times, you say it isn't about that at all. It's about kind of reform and repurposing and making a nimbler, more active, more effective workforce. It's not dollars and cents. It's not green eyeshade stuff. It's just about effectiveness in government. So I'm hoping at some point you can kind of clarify what really is this about. What is the sort of bumper sticker rationale? Is it all of those things? It could be more than one of those things. I'm not saying that they're mutually exclusive necessarily, but I guess if you could answer for us, is this about getting bloated state government, in your view, back under control? Is it about saving money that we can use to spend elsewhere in the state budget? Or is it about not really dollars and cents at all? Is it about repurposing and reforming as you see it and making us nimbler and quicker and more efficient? Which is it? I've heard different things, and it might be more than one of those things. I just want to make sure I understand your rationale here.
Representative Downey.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Simon, I think it's all of the above. And you asked for a bumper sticker, and I'm not great at bumper stickers, but it's really putting Minnesota state government on a sustainable footing for the future and having a sustainable cost structure that can withstand the modest revenue increases that we all anticipate.
Mr. Chair, I don't know,
Simon.
I don't know what's more sustainable than flat. That's about as sustainable as it gets. I think it's a little too simple to say, as I think you did, at least I jotted it down, that this is really not about letting people go, but it's really about repurposing them in the economy, as if they'll all be able to easily find private sector jobs that they're suited for. I think that's a mistake, and I think that's a little bit too simple. And I think we know many people in our lives, friends, relatives, etc., who are having a really tough time right now. And I don't think it's as simple as saying that someone loses a job and they'll just be seamlessly folded into the private economy. I think that's a big mistake. I've heard a lot of talk from a lot of people about what families do in times of economic distress. And it's true that families in economic distress cut costs. I think that's the first impulse, and rightly so. But families also take on debt, whether it's on a credit card or through other loans. Families also aggressively seek revenue. My constituents have either sold automobiles, sold lake cabins, sold other assets in the family in order to get money. And real families in Minnesota also seek public assistance of some kind. And I'm not just talking about poor people, whether it's student loans or grants of some kind, or businesses seek assistance from the state, whether it's through the Jobs E program or others. So I think it's way too simple to say that when families are in economic distress that all they do all the time is just cut. They don't, at least not the families I know. So I hope we can get away from that kind of talk about living within our means, because there are options available to real families in Minnesota all over, and kitchen tables everywhere, that that really mirror what state government does or can do. You've talked in broad terms, in sweeping terms, about the trend. And at the beginning of your presentation here and in other committees, you've talked about how we're on an unsustainable path in terms of state spending. I have to ask the question, and I want to avoid fighting past battles, but I think it's important in terms of context. Does Governor Pawlenty bear any responsibility for what you have diagnosed as the problem? Any at all?
Representative Downey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Simon, I can answer your direct question quickly and then maybe a broader response to some of your comments. My observation of the budget presented by the executive branch 2 years ago when I first got here was that had the legislature enacted it, we wouldn't be in this position. But I can't speak to a full eight-year cycle as to who bears responsibility. I think what we've seen at both the federal, local, and state levels is literally an unsustainable trend of spending far beyond what the economy can generate and leveraging debt, deficits, other techniques for 25 years. And in that context, I would disagree with your presupposition that flat is sustainable. One of my observations in state government is that flat equals perpetual increases. The status quo is what I'm really, I think, trying to get at. And to look at these charts, if we just had flat spending over the next 10 years, we'll still have deficits. For how many biennium? I mean, you can do some rough eyeballing here, and it's probably another five biennia before we, if we held spending flat, before revenues are going to catch up. So I'd argue that flat is unsustainable, and flat, unfortunately, equals the status quo. So I feel like when you talk about investment, I hear spending, deficit, debt, and more problems, a continuation of the 25-year trend that we've been on that we just absolutely have to put a halt to here in this legislative session.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Simon.
Well, I take that as a yes to my question, that yes, he bears some responsibility. I mean, just as theoretically we all would. If the problem is that we've had runaway spending, that yes, he bears some of the responsibility. Keep in mind that his budget from 2 years ago proposed borrowing $1 billion based on a tobacco bond scheme that was quickly sort of cast aside. So I think we got to get clear on that. You know, I've got in my hands here Governor Pawlenty's book, Courage to Stand, and you need no go no further than the book jacket itself to see that he claims that he tackled a crushing deficit, he tackled big government out of control and runaway spending. And if you look at some of the quotes in here, he claims that he, quote, held the line on the insatiable appetite for more government spending, end quote. He says he, quote, stopped the rising tide of state government spending, and that he did it not by increasing spending. So he claims, at least, his record when he's in South Carolina or at GOPAC or wherever else, he's saying that he tamed state government and that we're back on a sustainable course. Is he wrong?
Representative Downey?
Mr. Chair and Representative Simon, I'm not sure this is highly relevant to the bill. I do remember coming up with a composite of all the tax increase proposals that came through the legislature in my 2 years here, and I think it was about $6 billion worth in the aggregate. So to the extent that those tax increases weren't enacted by virtue of the chief executive, I think you might argue that he has a good point.
Members, this is not a book review here today. Whoever wants to organize a book review later, please.
That's great.
Our distinguished colleague, who is a real author,
would
take us up on that. Representative Simon?
Yeah. Well, I think the point is that, you know, Governor Pawlenty had many options available to him. He could have done a lot of this by executive order. He could have pushed for legislation that did this, so could you, so could others have, but that didn't happen in the last several years. And there's probably a reason for that. And the reason is that this stuff is really hard. And to treat it as if it's easy and it's just all about kind of management principles and looking at the budget like a math problem and kind of this cold, detached, distant, clinical approach, I think that's a real mistake. You know, the government does some good things and helps a lot of good people. You've been helped by it yourself, Representative Downey. I know that in your own business, you've had a lot of government contracts, which is why, by the way, I'm not questioning your motives. This is a statement against interest here. If anything, this kind of bill might, and this budget cutting might be against your personal financial interests. So I praise you for that. But you and others have been helped by government expenditures, and I just think we've got to treat that as a very serious factor. And I think this bill fails to do that, which is why I think we all know where it's headed. Thanks.
Mr. Chair, can I just respond real quick? I continue to hear interesting rhetoric that would be a good discussion if it were actually germane to the bill or accurately reflecting my comments. I think I'm on the record in every debate during my campaign, every newsletter I've put out, that this is hard work. But we've got to do it, and we can do it. And I would argue that this is one of the few first steps to actually getting down to doing the hard work as compared to somehow pretending that it's going to be easy. I've never said it was easy. I know how hard organizational change is. If this were easy, we'd do it in 6 months. But it's not. I'm giving the executive branch and the legislature 4 full years to find a way to implement the improvements and the changes that do our absolute best to not compromise the level of service, to treat our people decently, and to accomplish the real change, the sustainable change that we need as a state. And I think we'd be punting on our obligation to the citizens of the state of Minnesota if we didn't start down this tough path and get to this hard work. So I'm fully prepared for hard work, and it just starts with this bill. This is not the end.
Members, we have Gunther, Banyan, Kahn, Anderson, and Hayden still on the list. We also have another amendment that is before us. Either we can, our schedule for Tuesday is right now open because we've had difficulty getting people who would be available for us on Tuesday. We can carry this, hold this bill finally over till Tuesday. Otherwise, maybe we could avoid a meeting on Tuesday. So I'll go down the list here. Representative Gunther. Representative Banyan.
I'll pass too.
Representative Kahn.
He's
passed. Representative Anderson.
I'll pass too.
Representative Hayden.
I'll take my comments, Mr. Chair. And I'll make them really brief because I think that some of my colleagues on both sides have asked some of the questions that I wanted to ask. Just a couple of things that you said, Representative Downey, that I wanted to just address a little bit. One was that the people in your community are facing hard times as well as the people in my community are facing hard times. And just for context, not all, but a lot of folks that may face, and since we're using very general terms a lot in this, that are facing hard times, may go from a McMansion to a nice house because they had to scale down a bit. They might have sold their boat in order to come up with a little more money, or not take the second vacation of the year and just take one. The people in my community often have to go to the homeless shelter. They often have to sell their car and use Metro Transit and things of that nature. So I do want to put a little bit of a context that different people are in different situations and depending on the community that they are. And that's not a knock on the great city of Indiana. I love to go to 50th in France and have a bite to eat, but there are differences. And that my point is that people often have to come to government depending upon where they are in order to get some help, in order to get retrained, in order to feed their family. And I think we need to have really good quality people that are there to help them, that are there to be compassionate, but also help them get back on the path of self-sufficiency. And I just want to be sure that as we go through this process of saying that we need to cut or that our growth is unsustainable, that we do it in a way that's reflective of our values in this state. And I think you've said that. But I don't think that a cross-the-board cut is really the way to do it. I think the way to look for innovation is to talk to the departments. My mother-in-law is a most recent retiree of the state. She's now on the pension plan. And she talks to me a lot about things that she thinks that we can do and that she hopes that I can bring legislation forth or talk to people in her agency to find ways in which we can cut costs. That doesn't necessarily mean that we have to cut people. I'll give you an example that she was an ombudsman for the for older Minnesotans. They're currently down a couple of positions. So we have an aging workforce that is going towards retirement. Some of those folks may be headed to the nursing home or need housing with services. If there are providers out there that aren't doing the things that they're supposed to, that are kicking them out inappropriately, her organization is the one that looks in and makes sure that people are doing it right, that they're being treated humanely, that they're following the law in which they do it, which I think is really important. And so if we don't have those services, much less the police, the state patrol and others that we've all really talked about, our veterans that we really kind of hold near and close to us, I think that our most vulnerable citizens are really important. And so I want us to be sure that as we start to think about what we need to do, that we're taking into account that we have an obligation to the citizens of this community, that we have an obligation to those that have worked in the public sector who have given their life to service, just like those that were veterans, those that had done things that I continuously kind of hear, kind of step up the priority level. I personally don't think, let me say this so I won't be overly provocative. I have an awful lot of respect for people who work for this state, people that are in the public sector. And so I hope that as we continue to move these bills through, as we continue to look at it, that we do keep our rhetoric to a minimum and that we are respectful of the people that work there. Even today, I've heard some of us cross-examine some of our witnesses that I don't think is okay. I think it's okay to ask questions. I think it's okay to try to get the information, but I don't want us to demonize the folks that work awfully hard to keep our roads safe, to keep our seniors safe, that take our most vulnerable people and try to put them back on a path of them being sustainably personally. So I think that's just more of a statement, Representative Downey. I don't question your motives, but I do think we have to do much more work, and we have to talk to the experts, and that often is the people who are doing the work, and not assume that they're just keeping themselves in business for the sake of just getting a paycheck, but they actually do want to do the work. They actually are doing the work well, and they're actually doing it because they care about the taxpayer dollars and the people of the state.
Any reaction to that, Representative Downey?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and a brief reaction. I take your comments to heart, Representative Hayden, and I think almost universally I share them, and I don't know that my bill is contradictory to them, although others may interpret it that way. This is not an across-the-board cut. I'll give you a quick example. In the state of Washington, they went through a business process re-engineering activity, which in the end resulted in fewer employees, and they reduced the processing time on food stamp applications from 16 days to where 85% of them are processed the same day. And so I don't find that what we're talking about here to be inconsistent with continuing to serve people, and frankly, I think there's an opportunity to serve them better. So with that, Mr. Chair, I would renew my motion with the slight difference. I'd like to, if I could, renew my motion. Oh, I'm sorry, there's an amendment. Is that... Yeah.
I have an A11 amendment. Is that Representative?
Yes. Mr. Chair, I'd like to offer the A11 amendment.
Move. The A11 amendment has been moved by Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, very simple. If we're going to reduce the costs of the state workforce by 15%, management should share in that. Let's start with ourselves. This would reduce the salary for legislators by 15% effective 2015. And, Mr. Chair, I would request a roll call.
Roll call has been requested on A11.
Anderson.
Call the roll.
Anderson.
Excuse me. Do you have any discussion on that?
Representative Leidinger.
No, sir.
Representative Downey.
I would not urge support. If you'd like to sign on my bill, that reduces our compensation 5% and our per diem 15%. Effective this July as compared to 4 years from now, I'd encourage you to do that. This is 4 years out. It would do very little, if anything.
Representative, call the roll.
Anderson.
No.
Banyan.
No.
Benson.
No.
Downey.
No.
Gauthier.
Yes.
Green.
Yes.
Gunther.
No.
Hayden.
Yes.
Kahn, Lanning.
No.
Leidinger.
No.
Lilly.
Yes.
Lohmer.
No.
McElfetrick.
No.
Murphy. Murray. Oh, I'm sorry, Murphy.
Yes.
Murray.
No.
Simon.
Yes.
Slawik.
Yes.
Stendrud.
No.
Erdahl.
Tempted, but no.
Winkler.
Yes.
Me.
There being 7 votes for and 12 votes against, the motion to amend does not prevail. We will now call the roll on the bill itself. Representative Downey, would you restate what the motion is?
If I could, I'd like to change the motion, renew the bill for passage and re-referral
recommend
to the committee on
passage,
ways and means.
Recommend passage. He's changing his motion to recommend passage and re-referral of the bill to ways and means.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
That's the motion. Would you call the roll?
Anderson.
Yes.
Banyan.
Yes.
Benson.
Yes.
Downey.
Yes.
Gauthier.
No.
Green.
No.
Gunther.
Yes.
Hayden. No. Kahn. Lanning.
Yes.
Leidinger.
Yes.
Lilly.
No.
Lohmer.
Yes.
McElfetrick.
Yes.
Murphy.
No.
Murray.
Yes.
Simon.
No.
Slawik.
No.
Stendrud?
Yes.
Erdahl?
Yes.
Winkler?
No.
I didn't understand that. That was part of the amendment.
The motion prevails with 12 voting yes and 8 voting no. So the bill moves forward to Ways and Means. Members, we will cancel the meeting for next Tuesday. We will not meet. We will keep you posted on the agenda for the rest of next week. Meeting adjourned.